great to be here, particularly on such a cold day. Nice hot subject to warm us up. I have to preface my remarks by saying that although I've been engaged with Iran for some 20 years and I've written a lot about it, I definitely do not qualify as an Iran scholar. I'm a kind of a faux historian. I'm a popular historian. I'm a journalist. Even some of the people in this room I know have much deeper knowledge of particular areas of Iran, its history, its culture, than I do. So I have a kind of a general perspective, but in journalism we always used to say that the professor's perspective is an inch wide and a mile deep, whereas the journalist's perspective is a mile wide and an inch deep. We are great dinner guests because we can speak, we have great stories and we can speak with fascinating insight on many subjects, but only for 5 minutes. After that, we've run out. But I'll try to do it a little more comprehensively today. And since the Dulles brothers came up, I think I'll add a little bit about some new material that I think I came up with about the Dulles brothers and their connection with Iran. First of all, let me talk a little bit about my own engagement with Iran. As you just heard, I was the New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul. I was the first one. There had never been a New York Times correspondent in Istanbul. And, of course, there's a reason for that. Turkey was always way off on the edge of everything during the Cold War. It didn't really have a foreign policy of its own. It was just doing whatever NATO wanted. But then, with the falling away of the artificial divisions that shaped the Cold War, Turkey resumed its place as not on the edge of everything, but right in the middle of everything, which is where that piece of geography has been ever since the Trojan War. So my beat when I was in Turkey did not include Iran or any Middle Eastern countries. Of course, Turks do not consider themselves part of the Middle East. But like all New York Times foreign correspondents, I'm liable to receive a phone call at any moment telling me to go anywhere. And that did happen to me periodically. It was in 1997, so it's almost 20 years ago. I got a phone call telling me, you got to go to Iran. There's an election coming up. That was the election in which Khatami was elected as president. And I was told there was some problem with the person who was supposed to go. She couldn't get a visa, or she was sick, or whatever the problem was. Anyway, I got to go to Iran and cover this election campaign. Well, I was not a Middle East correspondent. I never studied the Middle East. This is something you can bear in mind when you read some of those New York Times stories. Some of those correspondents are thrown into situations in which they're, how can we put it gently, not deeply expert. But we have a certain amount of training that allows us to get through those situations. So I got to Iran really as a neophyte. I only knew one thing about the Middle East, really, was that most countries in the Middle East are made-up countries. They're just fake countries that were invented by British diplomats drawing lines on maps in some men's club in Pall Mall after World War I. It didn't take me long at all when I got to Iran to realize this is the opposite of a fake country. This is a country that has a very long history, a very deep culture, and has a population with a very strong sense of itself. The Iranians are very conscious of their role in history and their role in world culture. Iran, of course, was the first world empire. It produced those great figures of Cyrus and Darius and Xerxes. Cyrus is said to have written the world's first human rights document. He's on that mural in the U.S. Capitol about the great lawgivers of history. He's in the Bible as the man who freed the Jews from their Babylonian captivity. Persian contribution to literature and poetry and science, mathematics, is vast. And as I said, Iranians are very aware of this. Now, I came from Turkey, where in the 1920s, Atatürk decreed a change in the script, in the language. What it means is that nobody alive in Turkey today can read anything that any Turk wrote more than 100 years ago. They're completely cut off from anything that happened there, which was, I think, part of the reason Atatürk wanted to do this. That gives the state complete control over history. I had only been in Iran a couple of days when I went to a museum there, and I saw a spectacular piece of calligraphy that was about 1,000 years old. And I turned to my interpreter, and I asked her, can you read this? And she went over to look at it, and she said, yeah, pretty much. I can make it out. I can read it. what a change this was from being in Turkey, where nobody can read anything that was written 100 years ago. And here in Iran, people can read things easily that were written 1,000 years ago. That was a fantastic trip for me. I got to spend several weeks in a car driving all over Iran. It was an election campaign, so restrictions on foreign journalists were quite loose. I had a photographer. We went all over the country, and I was truly captivated by Iran. But one question kept recurring in my mind as I traveled around Iran on that first visit. And it's a question that I often ask myself when I get to a country with which I'm not familiar. And that is, how did this country get to be this way? I always ask myself sometimes, well, why did this country get to be rich and powerful? Or why is this country poor and miserable? In Iran, I was struck immediately by a huge gap, a huge contradiction. If you look at the size of Iran, the geographical location of Iran, its history, its culture, the sophistication of its people, you imagine where Iran should be in the world. But actually, Iran is not anywhere near that place. Instead of being a strong and self-confident, a prosperous world center, it's poor and isolated and unhappy. Why? Why such a disconnect? I asked this to people in Iran, and some of them kind of rolled their eyes a little bit. But I did have some people that were gentle enough to take me aside and tell me that, you ask why we never got to have a democracy here. But actually, we had a democracy here until you showed up and took it away from us. Well, I was a little bit taken aback by that. It doesn't fulfill my self-image as an American. Having heard a little bit about what happened in 1953, I resolved that when I got home, I was going to find myself a book about what really happened in 1953. Imagine my surprise to discover that there had never been a book written on this subject. Later on, I think I concluded why that is. Nations, like individuals, always like to stress those of qualities of ours that fulfill our own self-image. I think that's one of the explanations for the endless fascination with World War II in the United States. We love that story because we liberated countries that were under evil dictatorships, and when we left, they were democracies. So we like to hear that story over and over. But there were some other stories in our history that worked the other way around. And rather than confront those, I think just like individuals, we try to forget those stories because they don't confirm the self-image that we like to cling to. I came to realize that if I wanted to read a book about how Mossadegh was overthrown in 1953, I was going to have to write it myself. And that's what I did. That was that book, All the Shah's Men. As a result of that book and a number of other trips that I've made to Iran since then, I've become very engaged not only with Iranian history, but Iran of the present day. I'm actually leading another tour to Iran in May. I'm much looking forward to that because that'll be a fantastic moment to be there. So here's a little bit of what I draw from the Mossadegh story. I won't go through it all. Most of you are very familiar with this story. After World War II, Iran became a relatively strongly functioning democracy. It picked up the kind of fallen banner of the original constitutional revolution of the first decade of the 20th century. The democratic government of Iran, reflecting the will of the Iranian population, which is what democratic governments are supposed to do, decreed through an act of parliament the nationalization of Iranian oil. That oil was then owned 100% by a British company, and that British company was mainly owned by the British government. So Iran was sitting on an ocean of oil, and it was Iranian oil that was responsible for maintaining the standard of living in Britain all during the 1920s and 30s and 40s. Every factory in Iran was running on oil from Iran. The trucks and the cars were running on Iranian oil. The Royal Navy, which projected British power around the world, was run 100% on oil from Iran. Meanwhile, Iranians were living in some of the worst poverty anywhere in the world. It was this contradiction that led to the emergence of Mohammad Mossadegh and the decision that he championed to nationalize the oil resource. That, of course, set the British into a panic, and they tried a whole series of moves to overthrow Mossadegh. Finally, failing, they came to the United States. They asked President Truman if he would do this for them. He said no. CIA was then a new agency, and although Truman used it for covert action, he drew the line at overthrowing governments. That changed under the Eisenhower administration, and the Eisenhower administration agreed to go along with the overthrow of Mossadegh, and so that was kind of a joint British-American operation in 1953. That did not only result in the overthrow of an individual, but effectively the destruction of Iranian democracy in ways that have never been repaired. As a result of my research into the Dulles brothers, I've discovered a couple of new factors about this coup, and we're not here to talk about the coup in detail, although I would love to do that on another occasion. But I want to share with you a couple of new things that I think I found out that I had never read before about the background of that coup. We know from some of Eisenhower's biographers that he did not come into office with any grudge or any particular strong feelings about Mossadegh. The Dulles brothers, however, did. So John Foster Dulles was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, and his brother Alan was the CIA director. That was the only time in history that brothers have controlled the overt and the covert sides of American foreign policy. They did come into office with a major grudge against Mossadegh. And I want to talk just a little bit about where that came from. Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles were lawyers at a remarkable law firm in New York called Sullivan and Cromwell. That was not a law firm like any other. It didn't do what normal law firms did. If you needed things like a contract being drawn up or you needed to be represented in a courtroom, they could do that, but that's not why people hired Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell had a specialty. Their specialty was pushing around small and weak countries to make them do what big American companies wanted them to do. And that's why every major American corporation with multinational interests hired Sullivan and Cromwell. They were the masters of this. Now, in 1949, Alan Dulles received the biggest assignment of his legal career. He finally got a job that was big enough for his global ambition. Unlike his older brother, he never really was interested in the intricacies of law. Alan Dulles was hired by a conglomerate called OCI, Overseas Consultants, Inc. This was a group of the 11 biggest engineering companies in the United States. And they had a classically American, utopian vision. What they were going to do was find countries in the world and transform them, make them into Californias. They searched around the world. They had some big contracts under General MacArthur in Japan, but that not big enough. Anyway, they finally focused on Iran. Iran is a country that had some hard currency as a result of oil revenues. It was also receiving foreign aid from the United States and other countries. So OCI decided that it would use Iran as the proving ground for this very visionary ambition that it had. They needed to get the Shah's signature on what would have been the largest international development program of all time. They produced a 5-volume survey of Iranian resources. I think it might be the most exhaustive survey of Iran ever made. You can still find copies of it. There's one in the Harvard Business School Library. It tells you how many kilometers of pipe there is in Khorasan and what diseases the sheep have in Abadan. Every little detail is in there. Alan Dulles went to Tehran at the behest of OCI to obtain the signature of the Shah. He succeeded. The Shah agreed, and right after that, Alan Dulles brought the Shah to New York to speak to the Council on Foreign Relations, which was then really a kind of a shadow government. It was the center of the foreign policy elite. And essentially, Alan Dulles was introducing the Shah to the American foreign policy elite and saying, this is going to be our guy in Iran now. And the Shah gave just the speech they wanted to hear. We're open for investment. Our resources are virgin and waiting for development. We're not contemplating nationalization. I have a feeling Alan Dulles might have had something to do with that speech. But in any case, that was the connection. And that was Alan Dulles' greatest triumph. as a lawyer. While he was in Tehran negotiating the contract with the Shah, there was trouble in Iran. The Shah had staged an election, which he had tried to steal. And as a result, there was a protest. And while Alan Dulles was in Iran, several thousand protesters were camped on the lawn of the Shah's palace, demanding a new election, which the Shah finally had to agree to hold, as he was about to go to New York to address the Council on Foreign Relations and didn't want this hanging over his head. The leader of that demonstration was Mohammad Mossadegh. So this was the time when Alan Dulles focused on the Shah as our friend and Mossadegh as the dangerous, flamboyant populist who wants to undermine American interests. Sure enough, soon afterward, as Mossadegh began rising in Parliament, his National Front engineered the killing of the OCI contract. That contract was wiped away by a vote of Parliament. So that destroyed Alan Dulles' principal connection to Iran, and as I said, his greatest triumph as a lawyer. In addition, Alan Dulles and Sullivan and Cromwell represented a big bank called the Schroeder Bank. Alan Dulles was on the board of the Schroeder Bank. And the Schroeder Bank was the financial agent for the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. So when the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was nationalized, the Schroeder Bank lost its interest there. So Alan and Foster Dulles had to go back to some of their most important clients, OCI and Schroeder Bank, and say, "You hired us to protect your interests in Iran. You've just lost all your interest in Iran." They were not used to doing this. They never forgot that. Alan Dulles shortly thereafter left Sullivan and Cromwell and went into the CIA in a secondary position. One of his first acts was to write up a proposal that the CIA should launch a coup and overthrow Mossadegh. This was immediately vetoed by Acheson. So he had no choice but to wait. I tell you all this as background to show that these two brothers carried their grudge against Mossadegh from their days as private lawyers into high public office. They were not only fearing the example of Mossadegh, but they had had personal experience with what nationalism could mean. They not only were horrified by the idea of the nationalization of Iranian oil, but beyond that, they were horrified by the whole idea of nationalization. If small countries that have valuable resources can begin to set the terms by which those resources are exploited, that essentially upset the whole way the world was run. And I think the Dulles brothers understood that. So they came in with quite a panoply of grudges against Mossadegh. In 1953, they succeeded in overthrowing Mossadegh. It only took a matter of a few weeks. And in the summer of 1953, by the end of August, Mossadegh was imprisoned, and the Shah was beginning his 25 years of increasingly repressive rule. A lot of history came from those few weeks in August 1953. The Islamic Revolution was essentially a reaction to the 25 years of Shah's rule. That revolution produced all sorts of effects. Among others, it tempted Iran's biggest enemy next door, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, to invade Iran because Iran was in upheaval. That's what brought the United States to become an ally of Saddam Hussein. You can remember that President Reagan sent a personal envoy to visit twice with Saddam Hussein and ask what kind of military help we could give him. And that envoy was none other than Donald Rumsfeld. And that was the beginning of our death embrace with Saddam. It spiraled into all our Iraq troubles. The Islamic Revolution was one of those rare geopolitical events that not only terrified the Americans, it also terrified the Soviets. They were afraid that radical Islam would spread throughout all their southern republics, and that was one of the motivating factors for their decision to send Soviet troops into Afghanistan. That's what brought us into the Afghanistan War and started all of our trouble there. So for those reasons and many others, that 1979 revolution was profoundly important, and as I said, it's a delayed reaction to the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953. The 1979 revolution also produced the famous episode of the hostage crisis. This is profoundly important in considering U.S.-Iran relations. the principal reason why there's so much opposition today to reconciliation with Iran is emotion. It's the emotional hangover from the hostage crisis. I tell you, I don't spend much time in Washington, as little as possible, but whenever I go there, I try to meet with people that are a little bit more connected to Washington than I am, and I asked one guy that I know who's been covering Washington politics for probably almost as long as I've been alive about this. Why the intensity of anger about Iran? And he said, immediately, without pausing, he said, oh, it all goes back to the hostage crisis. We've never gotten over that. We feel that Iran hit us. They scored a triumph over us, and we've never really gotten them back. And until we can punish them for that, we shouldn't be talking to them. So for Americans, and certainly our political elite, U.S.-Iran relations begin and end with the hostage crisis. But for Iranians, the narrative looks very different. For Iranians, everything goes back to 1953. We hardly remember 1953. And for many of the Iranians, the hostage crisis was just something that happened while the Iran-Iraq war was going on, and all kinds of turbulence was happening, so they don't see that the way we see it. It created a situation in which these two countries have developed deep mistrust of each other, and with good reason. These are two countries that have harmed each other a lot. These are two countries that have inflicted damage on each other. And it's difficult to get beyond that. There's a tremendous overhang of bad feeling on both sides. Now, as many of you know, in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, Tehran was the only city in the entire Muslim world where people spontaneously came out in demonstrations of support for Americans. You can see videos of hundreds of people with their candles in the middle of the night marching through North Tehran in sympathy with Americans. It was the Iranians who then helped us in our project of overthrowing the Taliban. Of course, Iranians had hated the Taliban long before we did. We had a Taliban delegation coming to Texas and walking around in Walmart. I've often tried to find video footage of that, but I don't think there is any. But that was when the Iranians were already realizing what the Taliban was. When we decided we wanted to overthrow the Taliban, we didn't have anyone to do it for us. We didn't want to send in our own troops. We would do the bombing, but we needed somebody to act on the ground. Who was that going to be? We didn't know anybody in Afghanistan. But Iran is very deeply rooted in Afghanistan. Don't forget that the entire western third of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran up until Iran lost a war in the 18th century. So the language is the same. There are deep cultural and political ties there. It was the Iranians who connected us with the Northern Alliance. And that was the connection that led to our successful operation to overthrow the Taliban. Thereafter, the leader of the Northern Alliance naturally felt that he was the logical candidate to become president of Afghanistan, since he won the war. We didn't want that. We wanted a Pashtun. But how do we get that guy to stand down? How do we push them back after they won the war? The Iranians essentially did that for us. They went to the Northern Alliance and explained, you can't do this. We have to have the bond conference that produced Karzai. That was the Iranians. And I think the Iranians really felt they were on a track now to work more closely with the United States in recognition of our common interests. Instead, they got a big punch in the face when George Bush gave that famous speech in which he put Iran in the axis of evil, along with two of the most horrific dictatorships in the world, Saddam Hussein, Iraq, and North Korea. They were shocked by all of this. A couple of years later, in 2003, the Iranians actually made another overture to the United States. They sent a letter through the Swiss ambassador. He's the official conduit to the United States in Iran. In that letter, the Iranians said that they would accept, quote, full transparency in their nuclear program, and they would cooperate in transforming Hezbollah in Lebanon into, quote, a mere political party. The Americans not only did not respond to that offer, but we reprimanded the Swiss ambassador for having the temerity to bring it to us. That was another great missed opportunity in a history in which there have been many. That hostility that led us to not only reject but not even consider any kind of conversation or reconciliation with Iran has continued very strongly through various political epochs. And it hasn't been until quite recently when last year President Obama opened the idea of new talks with Iran that we've tried to break away from that. Let me just talk a little bit about how I see this process unfolding. We are now closer to a reconciliation with Iran than I think we've been in the last 35 years. I take my hat off to John Kerry. I don't know if it's just because he has a son-in-law who's Iranian and wants to go and visit, but I think he has recognized something that those of us engaged with Iran have seen for many years, and that is reconciliation with Iran is something that is very much in the interests of the United States. This is how I analyze the world in general. I'm an American, and I believe that it's perfectly fine for the United States, like any country, to promote its own interests in the world. So I'm all for the United States acting on behalf of United States interests. Let's do what's good for us, with the only caveat that we should stop and think what really is good for us over the long run and not take steps that make us feel good for a few minutes but actually undermine our security interests over the long run. Now, the recognition on both sides that we have common interests is what is driving this process. So what are some of those common interests? Now, during the Bush administration, it was explicitly forbidden to promote anything that could be interpreted as a confidence-building measure with Iran. It was explicitly, it was an explicit rule in the administration. Confidence-building measure would be try to start cooperating on something that's not political and see if you can start to work together on something. For example, Iran probably has the world's greatest heroin addiction problem. Look around our newspapers today, look what's happening in our country now. We're also facing a serious problem with opiate addiction. Afghanistan is the center of where all that is coming from. This would be a great confidence-building project. It's not political. Hundreds of Iranian policemen have been killed in fighting smugglers near the Afghan border. But that was something that was forbidden. It was also forbidden under the Bush administration to refer to Iranian security interests, much less legitimate security interests. As far as we were concerned, Iran had no legitimate security interests. They only had aggressive intent, hegemonic intent. I think that's changed now. What is the value to the United States of reconciliation with Iran? First of all, if you look at a map of the Middle East, something jumps out at you right away, and that is Iran is the big country right in the middle. It's equivalent to what you see when you look at a map of Europe, and you see Germany right in the middle. After the Second World War was coming to an end, there was intense anti-German emotion, not surprisingly. And for a time, the United States pursued something that was called the Morgenthau Plan, where we were going to divide up Germany, turn it into an agricultural country, and forbid Germany from ever having a factory again. After a few months, cooler heads prevailed, and we decided to go in the opposite direction. And we embraced this idea of the Marshall Plan. Don't beat them down. Try to draw them in and create a regional security architecture in which Germany would have a place. That, I think, is also the way to help stabilize the Middle East. You need to have an architecture in which all countries can participate. Iran has a great ability to influence the course of events in Iraq. Of course, Iraq is the only country in the world that has a Shia government, other than Iran itself. And I can tell you something about Iraq that I don't think I could say about other countries. I know that Baghdad will never fall to the forces of ISIS or any al-Qaeda-related group, nor will Najaf, nor will Karbala. It will never happen. Why do I know that? Because Iran will not let it happen. Iran is out there doing the things that Americans are not able to do. They are on the ground in ways that we're horrified by, but actually is producing a result that's good for us. So stabilizing Iraq is a project with which we can, on which we can work very closely with Iran. Iran has a much greater ability to do that. But of course, they only want to help stabilize Iraq if they're sure that the United States is not going to use Iraq as a springboard for attacking them. Iran also has a great ability to help stabilize Afghanistan, which is another huge interest of the United States. We are desperate to pull out of Afghanistan, but we don't want to see it collapse into complete chaos. Iran is a way to prevent that from happening. Now, the negotiations now seem to have progressed to an advanced stage. I think we're at a point now where two big questions are being debated, and they're essentially, we're looking to find two numbers that both sides can agree on. First of all, the reason these talks were made possible is not, as we're sometimes told, that Iran finally broke under the pressure of our sanctions. Like, this is the narrative in Washington. We beat them really hard, and finally we beat them so hard that, as Reagan liked to say, they said uncle. They gave up. They couldn't handle it anymore. That's actually not what happened. Iran has been under sanctions for 35 years. They could probably live under them for another 35 years. Terrible economic management inside Iran has been much more responsible for the economic troubles in Iran than the sanctions. But something important changed in Washington, and that is we changed our offer. Our policy used to be Iran may not enrich any nuclear fuel. There can be no uranium enrichment. Zero. We've now changed that. Obama's offer was, we're going to negotiate. What's going to be the level of enrichment that's going to be possible? That was a big breakthrough, and I think that was an important factor in getting these negotiations going. So we're now trying to negotiate, what is that level? How do we shape an enrichment program that satisfies Iran's legitimate needs, but doesn't threaten the outside world? The other piece that we're trying to negotiate is the length of special surveillance measures that the world will take to watch over Iran. As a result of whatever agreement emerges from these talks, Iran will be under closer supervision by international authorities than any other country in the world regarding its nuclear program. How long is that going to go on? Is that going to be 3 years or is it going to be 30 years? That's the other piece we're trying to negotiate. But I think there is a recognition on both sides that this situation has become urgent enough that we have to put aside our emotions. Emotion is always the enemy of wise statesmanship. And emotion has been what has blocked this reconciliation, even though it is very much in the interests of both countries. I'm optimistic that an agreement is going to emerge, despite opposition on both sides. And the reason simply is that in the end, and I hope we're coming to the end, foreign policy is all about interests. When you strip away everything else, interest is what guides countries. And it is in the urgent interest of both countries that this deal be reached. Iran is not the snarling, turbulent, threatening force in the Middle East that you sometimes hear portrayed when you're listening to our members of Congress. Iran is actually an island of stability in an increasingly turbulent region. There is intense opposition, as all of you know, on both sides to this agreement. We have ayatollahs in Tehran and ayatollahs in Washington that are terrified at the idea of reconciliation. And I understand that. The paradigm of hostility is so deeply ingrained, many people cannot imagine another way, another kind of relationship, and are deeply invested in the paradigm of hostility. In Iran, for example, much of the opposition and attempts to undermine the negotiating process have come from the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard is the most repressive organ in Iran. When you saw those pictures during the Green Revolution of people riding motorcycles and beating the demonstrators with sticks and shooting them, those were the Revolutionary Guards. Now, the Revolutionary Guards have gotten rich off our sanctions. They love the sanctions because, and I've seen sanctions, this is my third go-around with sanctions. I watched the sanctions in Serbia, and I also watched the sanctions in Iraq. Now I'm seeing them in Iran. And in all three places, I see the same pattern emerging. Sanctions don't prevent anything from getting into the country. Everything is available. If you go to the Tehran Bazaar, you're going to see every iPhone. The same day it appears in the Boylston Street Apple Store. It's amazing. Everything is there. How does it get there? Well, in all these countries, when there are sanctions, there emerge sanction busters. It's entrepreneurial. The sanctions busters in Iran are the Revolutionary Guards. That's their business. They are running the speedboats across the Persian Gulf from Dubai by the dozens every day. By our sanctions, we are financing the most brutally repressive organ in Iran. And that has been the case now for decades. If the sanctions disappear, the Revolutionary Guards are in trouble. They don't want that to happen. They love the sanctions project. So they're doing what they can to upset reconciliation. In Washington, I think, as I said, this emotional overhang is intense. But I really feel that it doesn't have to do specifically with Iran. I have this Washington fantasy that some congressman or senator is ranting about Iran, and I interrupt him by jumping up and saying, "Excuse me," and I hold up an outline map of the world, and I say, "Can you show me where is Iran on this map?" Because I don't think they know where Iran is. And in fact, although they feel that they need to denounce Iran to support Israel, I don't think most of them can even find Israel. Iran is not a specific country, a specific place. Iran is just the name that we now give to the force of horrific barbarism that always threatens civilization. It was the Huns back in the Roman Empire, communists, terrorists. It's now Iran. Iran is the name of the diffuse force that hates all civilization. We've gotten to a point where the concept of Iran is almost completely disconnected from the reality of Iran. Now, a lot of the anti-Iran sentiment in Washington, of course, is driven by Israel. I truly believe that if Israeli leaders were to announce for whatever reason tomorrow that they no longer have any fears of Iran and they wouldn't care whether the U.S. and Iran got together, the air would blow out of the anti-Iran balloon almost overnight. Israel is driving a great deal of this, and that will be intensified when the Israeli Prime Minister appears in front of Congress soon. I had an interesting experience the last time I was in Israel. I actually went to speak at a conference about Iran. And if you want to get detained at the Tel Aviv airport, just tell them you're coming to give a talk about Iran. And sure enough, that's what happened. They told me in the invitation, you'll certainly be detained. Have them call this number and we'll tell them it's okay. That's just what happened. Anyway, we had our nice conference, and then we went off to a nice hotel overlooking the Mediterranean. And there were about a dozen of us. They brought the panelists to a nice dinner. And then appeared a leading figure of the Israeli government as a surprise after-dinner speaker. The first thing he said was, "Are there any reporters in the room?" And I reflexively, I wanted to raise my hand, but I realized I'm not here as a reporter. I'm not working, so I just minded my own business. And he gave a really interesting talk. It was kind of a tour d'horizon of how Israel sees the world. About half of it was about Iran. And he said something I found absolutely fascinating. He said, "You know, you're reading in all your newspapers back home that Israel's terrified of Iran getting a nuclear weapon because we're afraid as soon as they get it, they're going to bomb us." Well, actually, that's half true. We are, again, very much against Iran having a nuclear weapon, but not for that reason. Actually, in our security establishment, nobody believes that Iran would ever use their nuclear weapon against Israel. They knew that would mean their liquidation as a state, and they wouldn't do that. But we don't contradict that narrative because it sounds good, so we let it stay out there. But we're against Iran having a nuclear weapon for other reasons. First is, when you have a nuclear weapon, you don't have to use it. You can intimidate people just by having it. And of course, the Israelis would be experts in that fact. And second, we fear that if Iran has nuclear weapons, other countries will want to get it. Pretty soon, Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Egypt will have them, and then we're really going to be in trouble. In fact, the entire aim, from the point of view of the United States, of the negotiations now underway is to assure that Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. That is going to be the guarantee. If that's your goal, then you should be supporting these negotiations. Iran will be under, as I said, closer supervision than any country in the world. And as long as any agreement is in effect, Iran will never get close to having a nuclear weapon. So why is it that the Israelis and their friends in Washington are so intensely opposed to an agreement which will have as its central feature a guarantee that Iran never has a nuclear weapon. It's because I take them at their word on this one. They recognize that Iran is logically, because of its size, its culture, its location, its history, going to be a country that has influence in the region. And they're terrified of this. They feel that Iranian influence will be inherently destabilizing to the region. It may be destabilizing to some terrible regimes, but actually Iran is a stabilizing force in the region. The terror that Iran is going to be setting out to depose regimes and to subvert nations is misplaced. Iran can be brought in to become a responsible actor in the Middle East, but Iran needs to be recognized. You know, sometimes I think in these negotiations, we don't only need interpreters from one language to another, we actually need cultural interpreters. I can understand how these negotiations would go. At the beginning, in many negotiations between parties that have been hostile for a long time, one of the techniques diplomats use is to ask each other, what would be the one thing you'd like to get out of this negotiating process? Well, I mean, if you ask the Americans, one thing they would say is, well, we want to be sure Iran never has a nuclear weapon. And the Iranians, I know what they would say. They say, the one thing we want is, we want respect. And the Americans say, yeah, but that's not a thing. What do you really want? Well, give us something concrete. We want to be treated for who we are. We don't want to be pushed around. We want to be recognized. Americans have a hard time grasping this. Iranians come out of a culture drenched in poetry and a kind of fatalism. You know, Iranians, one thing I've learned from Iranians is that actually most problems in the world never get solved. Americans are great problem solvers. Iranians have taught me the real challenge of life is to understand the problems you have and adapt to them. Just live with them. See how you can deal with reality. Americans want to change reality all the time. So I do believe that in the next few months, we are going to see a very interesting change in this relationship. Nobody knows for sure what's going on behind closed doors, but my sense is that things are going fairly well. Both sides, at least around the negotiating table, recognize that an agreement would be in their interest. But those negotiations going on between the Iranian delegation and the American delegation are not the only negotiations. There's also the negotiation between the Iranian negotiators and the hostile factions back in Tehran. That's an intense negotiation. Then there's the negotiation between the American delegation that's negotiating and the militant anti-Iran campaigners in Washington. That's also going to be a very difficult one. And finally, there is the negotiation that the United States has to make with our other so-called allies in the region. We have to find a way to placate both Israel and Saudi Arabia and make them understand that this agreement is actually good for them in the long run. So I'm going to look forward and try to be positive at this moment, look forward to an agreement that will allow John Kerry, before he leaves office, to go and visit his son-in-law's family in Tehran. He's going to visit Iran. On the way home, he's going to stop in Tel Aviv and Riyadh. They won't be happy. But I do believe this is going to happen, and I can say this. There is no single step the United States could take anywhere in the world that would produce such an immediate leap in national security for our country as reconciliation with Iran. I applaud Obama for having recognized that, and I'm hoping it's going to produce something that will finally break this 35-year logjam. Thank you.